session number 16487, Reel 2.
Dr. Frankel, Reel 2.
Not really. I understood that the ordinary people, the doctors there, felt that the German shouldn't work there. But on the other hand, I had already been before a tribunal which graded the aliens into different groups, and I was in a group which was regarded as a friendly alien. But I didn't pay much attention to that at that time, at the hospital, although I was not debarred from obtaining other employment.
Had you appeared before a tribunal?
Yes, yes.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, I was at that time in Acton, and I think it was in the magistrate's court. There were three people there, and they asked me about my background and what I was doing and so on, and they passed me as a friendly alien, fully entitled to participate in whatever work I wanted to do. I was given complete freedom.
Were you satisfied with the proceedings of the tribunal?
Very satisfied, yes, perfectly. Very good.
What was their demeanor and attitude?
Very friendly. Helpful.
So you'd lost your job. What
yes.
did you do?
Well, that was I went to my parents, who by that time had not got a house yet. I had a little money for my job, and I applied for other jobs, and I then actually went to as assistant in general practice here in Essex, where I worked for 6 months. The doctor whom I replaced had been called up. He was a territorial army officer, so I took his place.
Whereabouts in Essex?
In Harlow. And I worked there for 6 months during the winter, first winter of the war.
How did that suit you after hospital work?
Well, I've never regretted it. It was a very interesting, I think it was an excellent experience for any doctor who wanted to do hospital work later on. I look back on it with great satisfaction. I can still remember it very vividly.
It seems odd that the authorities in Britain should have thought it necessary to sack you from a hospital job and yet give you a GP's job.
Well, it wasn't the authorities sacked me, but the doctors at the hospital. Nothing to do with the authorities. And the GP job I got myself. I applied for it. See, they had to find a replacement for the doctor. I think it was through an agency. And that was very nice, this job. It was in a big house in those days, Harlow Newtown didn't exist, you see. All this area was farmland and farms. And this lady, doctor's wife, was a very charming lady. Every evening she came down and dressed, you know, an evening dress, and was very formal. And I worked very hard delivering babies in the country, middle of the country, winter nights, and so on. It was very good.
When you say it was the doctors at Acton Hospital who
sent you,
how do you mean? What body was it?
Medical Staff Committee.
What did they say to you?
Well, I'm afraid we can't have you anymore. Because, you know, you're not British. Actually, one of the members of the staff was Lord Porritt. Do you remember Lord Porritt?
No.
Surely you know him. He was governor of New Zealand. He came from New Zealand. He was a famous surgeon. You'd never heard of him, Lord Porritt. He was my chief then.
So you said you were in this job in Harlow for about 6 months.
Yes.
What happened then?
And then I wanted to go back to hospital work, and that's how I got to Old Church Hospital at Romford. I applied for that post and I was appointed assistant medical officer. And I started that job on the 1st of April, 1940. And that was the reason why I was interned. Because it was in the Essex area, and all aliens and, you know, all so-called enemy aliens in the coastal areas were interned.
What exactly was your job at Romford?
Assistant medical officer.
So, were you arrested?
Yes.
Can you describe what your arrest was like?
Yes. I think it was the 22nd of May, I think. On a Sunday afternoon, at 2 o'clock, I was just going out to meet my wife, actually. It was now my wife, but then we weren't married then, you see. She was to meet me at Romford Station at 2:30. And at 2 o'clock, these people appeared, two policemen in a car, and they just took me. I just had a little case with toothbrushes and of course all my things were left there, and I just had a little case with a few things, and they took me to Worley Hospital, which was the place where they interned all the people from Essex.
What was their attitude towards you?
Well, they were quite friendly. They just said, I was registered with the police, you see, in Romford, obviously. When you, as an alien, when you changed your residence, you had to register with the local police. So they came from the police station. Well, there were CID people from Romford. They just said, we've got to take you. You're interned. And they took me to the Worley Hospital.
Was it a complete surprise to you?
Indeed, yes. It was a terrible shock. I'd arranged to meet my, Connie, my wife, at 2:30. I was just going to the station. She never knew where I was. I never turned up. So when I didn't turn up, she went to the hospital and she was told that I had been taken away.
What did you find at Worley?
Well, they brought in people all the time. There was no preparations made at all. We just left in empty wards. There were no beds. We had to sleep on the floor. And there were all sorts of people there. You know, all kinds. It was an incredible mixture. There were old Germans there who'd been living in England for generations. Not generations, for a long time. There were tradesmen whose sons were actually in the British Army. There was one chap there who was an engineer, a German, whose son was guarding him outside. He was in the army. And there were doctors there, scientists, all sorts of people. And, of course, Jewish refugees as well, but also Germans. It must have been about, 150 to 200 people there. We stayed there till June.
Were conditions organized or chaotic?
Well, at first they were completely chaotic. But then gradually they were organized. You know, we were allowed to go out walking and walking around, and there was feeding. But, I mean, the facilities were, there were no beds, or we slept on mattresses on the floor. And of course I had nothing with me, you see, no clothes, no pyjamas or no washing facilities. It was pretty awful to be moved like this. If I hadn't been in Essex, I wouldn't have been interned, you see. My father wasn't interned.
Where was your father?
He was in London with my mother. They didn't know where I was.
Was your fiancée able to bring you things?
No. She didn't know where I was. No. I just was completely cut off.
what was the behavior of the guards like towards the internees?
Well, you know British soldiers, I mean, they're usually very nice people, you know, friendly, and they don't treat you badly unless you're obstreperous. They were just polite and guarded us. The internal arrangements, camp arrangements, were done by the internees themselves, you see. They organized the kitchen and whatever required, was it called, cleaning.
Did you appoint a camp leader?
Not there, no, no. No, that was quite disorganized.
Where did you go to from Wally?
Well, they took us, I think we stayed there for about 3 weeks, I'd say. I can't remember the exact details. And then they took us to Highton, near Liverpool, by train.
What was the train journey like?
Very long, all day. It went from, you know, along the east coast, Suffolk, and then across the country. It was a cross-country journey, Norfolk, and right across to Liverpool, not via London.
Were you able to be comfortable on the journey?
No, it was an awful journey. We didn't really know where we were going.
Did you have seats?
I can't remember that. That wouldn't have been very important anyhow. But we didn't know where we were going. That was the worst thing.
What did you find at Highton?
Well, they put us into a new housing estate, which consisted of empty houses. New, not completed. With streets and small council houses. And we were allocated a house, six, or I don't know how many, to a house. And there, things were organized better. I think they appointed leader. But I was so depressed in Highton when I got there. I was really, I would say, completely finished, really. In fact, I would say the first fortnight, I was really suffering from a severe depression because I was, you know, being torn from one's job and my parents in London. No money, nothing, no facilities to communicate, no knowledge what's going to happen, the war going on. And I would say I really had a breakdown. For a fortnight I lay on the floor in this empty house and didn't move. It was desperate, really, at that time. I just didn't know what to do. By the time I got to Highton, I had a breakdown. Not that I did anything or complained. I just kept to myself when I was very low.
What do you think brought you out of the depression?
Well, I mean, it just doesn't... depression is typical of a depression. It doesn't go on forever. If it gets too bad, people commit suicide. And otherwise, they get over it. See, I'm not normally a depressed person. I'm normally a person who deals with circumstances and events very quickly and adequately. And once I got over this terrible period, I was all right again. At least I could cope.
Were there any activities there in which you could engage to occupy yourself?
No, not really. I can't remember even meeting anybody. I remember there were some, I was completely isolated, but I remember, this is quite interesting, it was large number, may have been 2,000 people there, you see, in this housing estate. And there was a group of people who would stand out. You know, you could see there were leaders, and a tall man, very intelligent, middle-aged, and they found themselves or found each other, and they took on the leadership of this camp. They were internees themselves, obviously, but it's amazing how in a group of people who collect together quite spontaneously and without previous intention of putting them together, there are always some people who stand out and take over. It was very interesting that I can still remember these men. I don't know who they were, but they were probably very prominent people, I would say. You know, really good people who later on took a very, must have taken on a prominent part in the war effort.
Was there leadership of a kind that was a benefit to everybody, or was it used selfishly?
No. It wasn't really a very, the leadership, it was really only a, it wasn't a real leadership, because there was no camp leader, you see. There were just people who found each other and who tried to represent the views and attitudes of the internees, but not on a leadership basis. The real leadership were the camp commandant, you know, the officer in charge.
How did the commandant and the guards behave towards the internees at Heighton?
Well, there was hardly any contact at all. See, the situation at Heighton was you lived in these houses, you went to certain areas for food, and you could attend a hospital if you needed it, and then there were announcements made of general interest, but there was no real contact between the administration and the internees until we were moved away.
How long were you there for?
I should say about 3 weeks, maybe.
Can you describe the move?
Yes. Well, you see, then it was announced that there would be two transports. We would be moved in two transports. We were not told where we were going. And the names of these two transports were announced. And one transport of about 800 people left, and then on the next day, or 2 days later, the other group left, the same number. We didn't know where we were going, but actually we walked. We had to walk to Liverpool dock, and there we were put on a ship. We didn't know where the ship was going, but we were put on it. And, you know, the first group were taken on board of the Andorra Star. You heard of that, haven't you?
Yes.
So that I wasn't on that group, on that ship. It was just the luck of the draw. Otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. They all drowned. They were the people who went the day before. And then we went on 2 days later, and we went on another ship, and that was quite an adventure.
What was the name of that ship?
I can't remember. It was a big merchant ship, empty, all the holds empty, with ladders from one to there were six holds. And we were moved right into these, to the bottom up, about 800 to 1,000 people. Each hold was empty, and they were moved down. And again, a completely desperate situation. It's like a slave ship, really. The only thing, there were there's nothing there, only empty space. And the top where we had to move, the top was, of course, closed by barbed wire. And at first it was all confusion, but then there was a shout almost immediately that there was somebody dying there, you see. Is there a doctor there? So I went to see, and there was a chap who was actually in a diabetic coma and lying on the floor there. And of course I couldn't do anything, so I went up to the top, to the barbed wire. There was a soldier, armed soldier outside, and I said, "Get me the ship's doctor, you see, I'm a doctor myself." So after a few minutes, the ship's doctor arrived, and I said to him, "Well, look here, I'm a doctor," and told him who I was, "and there's this man with a diabetic coma." and he needs immediate treatment, otherwise he'll die. So the poor chap, he was a really junior to me, you see. He was a young doctor, I think he was from St. Thomas's Hospital. And he said to me, my goodness, he said, you collect all the sick people, he said, take them to the ship's hospital and look after them. And that's what I did. I took about 15 people. And we went to the, you know, took me to the ship's hospital, which was really only part of a few, you know, cabins. It wasn't a hospital. And on this ship, there were also German sailors who'd been taken prisoner at Narvik. They took these men prisoner. They were Nazis, you know, real German sailors in the Navy. They were treated better than these internees, actually. They were also up there, but not in the ship's hospital. They were next to us. And I organized I looked after these people while we were, so there was a surgeon there, also a refugee, who came from Harwich. He was the surgeon at Harwich Hospital. Very nice chap called Levy. I was very friendly with him afterwards. We all kept, you know, very good friends. We remained very good friends until he died. He was older than I am. And he operated on the ship, on people who had acute surgical emergencies. We became very close friends.
Did the diabetic survive?
Yeah, oh, yes. The diabetic was a first-rate artist called Moratz. He was a very good painter, really very good. And he survived, yes. I'm very, very glad I managed to get to look after him.
What other conditions did you have in the ship's hospital?
Well, we were in cabins, you see, right on the top. We had the cabins. It's a merchant ship, but there were some cabins there. We had bunks, you know, it was quite comfortable there.
No, I meant, what other medical conditions did you have?
There was a chap with epilepsy, an acute abdomen, infectious conditions, lung conditions, sore throats, mental trouble. Well, it kept quite busy.
And how did the guards treat you in that ship?
Well, we had very little contact with guards, you see. I mean, we were really free. We were not in the ship, in the ship's holds, you see. We were above it. Really, we could go on deck, and we had really like a... We were passengers, really. Very lucky. Very fortunate. The guards we had, or came in contact with, were very polite.
Were people's possessions safe aboard ship?
I would say so, yes. I had no possessions at all. And I had nothing.
How long did the voyage take?
It took about 10 days. It took us to up the Lawrence and Lawrence River to Quebec. And that was really quite extraordinary, because in 1936, my father arranged a holiday. In those days, from Hamburg, one could still do this. And I joined the ship in Southampton. He was on the ship. It was a German cruise ship. We went to Canada, and we stayed in this hotel, Chateau Frontenac, which is a famous hotel on the St. Lawrence River. And when we were in town, I was a few hundred yards below it on the Plains of Abraham, seeing the hotel where it stayed 2 years previously, or 3 years previously. It was a bit of a joke.
And how were you received in Quebec?
Well, now, that's a tragic story, really. We arrived in Quebec, we disembarked, and they marched us from the harbour on the St. Lawrence River up to the Plains of Abraham, up where the camp was. And there were armed guards, armed soldiers on either side, and the population of Quebec thought we were all Nazis. And German prisoners of war or spies and infiltrators, fifth colonists, and they shouted at us, you know, and threatened us with gestures. And this was quite, to some people, it became intolerable. And they lost their, they became maniacal. And when we got to this camp, they put these people who lost control into the prison of the camp, which was a hut on the periphery. And there they were kept behind barbed wire. And they became destructive, you know, shouting and threatening. There were three of them, I think. And then, you see, when we got there, there was a captain, commandant of the camp, and he asked who the doctors were. And, you know, I came forward because I had been the ship's doctor. So he put me into the ship, into the hospital, which was a hut next to the prison. And that's where I had my a room, you see, or space. And we had the encrypted with drugs and wash basins and meat and syringes and all that. It was a little camp hospital. And then the first night, there was a terrific to-do in the prison. You see, they're shouting, they're smashing the glass. And it was right next to where I was. And then the Canadian soldiers shot into the prison, and they killed these three chaps. And the tragedy was, when I was called in there, and at night, and there were these three people writhing on the floor, bleeding, shouting, "Down with Hitler! Down with Himmler! Down with Goering!" And I shall never forget that. It was terrible. It was one of the most desperate situations I've ever seen. And I don't really like to think of it now. These were chaps we had on the ship, you see, and they couldn't take it. They were Jewish refugees, and they were shot dead by these Canadian soldiers who thought they were German fifth colonists. And they just shot at them. Young Canadian soldiers, you can't, I suppose, blame them, I don't know. And they lost control. And then these people shouting, "Down with Hitler," while they were dying, shot by Canadian soldiers. It was really a dreadful situation.
But you were the doctor called in to attend.
Yes. And then they moved them to a hospital, you see. I mean, we had no facilities there. They moved and they died. And this became known. And when I came back to England, when I got back to England, the father of the house was a Labour MP called George Strauss. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes.
He asked me to see him in the House of Commons because they heard about this, you see, and he wanted me to report to him what happened. But again, it was one of these things. In the middle, you know, it was just one of these things in a war. But it was pretty awful.
So there was nothing that could be done to these men?
No. They died.
What happened next?
Well, this camp was run by the internees, and there were some very good people there in this camp. You know, one of the people was this Fuchs, the atom spy, you know? And the funny thing was, you know who the camp leader was?